I'll start off with a premise that that sort of formulated this meeting, and that premise is basically that higher education in general, and Cornell University in particular, has been and will be making financial decisions, whether things should grow, we should get more money in this way, whether we should cut this expense or that expense. And many of these financial decisions have enormous consequences for the educational venture that we're all involved with. And so the purpose of this is to try to get the faculty more involved in some of the ongoing discussions concerning revenue enhancement. We will specialize here, particularly with professional master's degrees toward the second half of the program. And the reason for that is virtually all the colleges have either increased or will be increasing or planning to increase professional master's degrees as a revenue stream for themselves. It's up to us again to decide what sort of streams we want to try to encourage in terms of revenue growth. There are reasons that these may come at a cost. There are reasons why these benefit our students, may benefit other parts of our enterprise. And so there are good reasons for doing these things, but we need to know what those reasons are and be sure that we, faculty, the people who are carrying out this, are making decisions, or at least helping to make those decisions. No need to take notes, not that any of you are, but this is supposed to be on Cornell Cast, and so we can look forward to seeing it there. So let me just very quickly review the program. We have five speakers. I sort of step in occasionally, but five speakers basically. The first speaker will set up the stage, Ron Ehrenberg. I'll tell you more about him, but basically he's going to tell us why the university has changed and how one might solve that problem or how it's changed dramatically. We'll have a couple of data people coming up talking about what the current landscape looks like, and then three people who represent various takes on master's programs within the university. And then finally, hopefully around 6 o'clock, we'll open up the floor, or around 5:30 rather, open up the floor for questions and comments, and then those who are engaged or who just want free wine and cheese can go to the gallery and continue the conversations that started there. So let's get started. Our first speaker is Ron Ehrenberg. He's the Irving Ives Professor of ILR and Economics. He's probably the most notable expert on higher education in the country. And so we're very fortunate that he's on our faculty. He's a former trustee of the university, currently serving as a trustee of SUNY as well. Very expert, and he'll set up the thing. Ron.
So this is forward and back.
Possible to turn off the light that's shining on the screen and making it difficult to see.
Is it possible to turn off the light some?
Better. I'm going to be brief. I'm the opening act. Opening acts are supposed to be brief. And I'm not going to have time to explain anything I say and explain all the forces, but what I can tell you is that there is a link on the meeting notice that went out today that refers to, which will take you to a magazine article that I published in 2013 called "Is the Golden Age of the Private Research University Over?" 2 years, and that has all the details. Two years later, I think the answer is yes. This is my 40th year as a tenured faculty member at Cornell. I came here with tenure. I was only 11 at the time when that happened. And it's hard for me to believe that I've been here for 40 years. But I have been fortunate enough, and people of my vintage have been fortunate enough to live in what I think has been the golden age of the private research university. Over the last 40 years, our undergraduate admissions have persistently gotten more selective, and it's unbelievable how good our undergraduate students are. The growth of federal research funding has enabled many of us to do substantially more research than we ever dreamed of, and to educate and work with more PhD students than we thought was possible. Many of us are teaching fewer, I know no one in this room will admit it, but many of us are teaching fewer classes than we did when we first got here. And while as faculty members we regularly complain about our salaries and we compare ourselves to the institutions that are much richer than us, in fact, our salaries far outdistance the salaries of faculty at other types of institutions other than the private research universities. And by the way, if you come to the Faculty Senate meeting in April, there's going to be a presentation by Larry Bloom, the chair of the Financial Policies Committee, on how our salaries actually do currently stack up. And so my bottom line is that for people like me, being a faculty member at Cornell during this period of time has been, and it still is, a great gig. But what I want to tell you today is that our institution's financial model and the financial model of all private research universities is breaking down. I also want to tell you that you're very lucky that you're not at a public research university, because the problem of the public research universities make our problems look insignificant. And there are four reasons why our financial model is breaking down. The first reason is that over the last 30 years or so, we have been able to increase our tuition by 3 to 3.5% a year, more than the rate of inflation. Why we did that, you can sort of think about, but what has happened is that over time, our tuition relative to median family income has grown dramatically, and we have reached a point now that basically the political and economic forces limit our ability to raise tuition as rapidly as we have in the past. The second reason is that our financial aid policies have led us to the point where now at the margin, when we raise tuition by a dollar, we give back 45 cents of that dollar to our undergraduate students in the form of financial aid. So we actually generate very little revenue from undergraduate tuition increases to run the rest of the university. The third reason has to do with how we fund research. Over time, if you go back to 1970, about 10% of the dollars that we spent on research came out of our own pocket. Over time, that increased to 20%, and as our research volume increased, that meant increasingly we were spending money on research. And we have gotten to the point where we may now be subsidizing research out of undergraduate tuition dollars. And I did an econometric study about a decade ago that showed that other factors held constant, when a university increases its expenditures on research out of its own pocket, that the following things happen. Undergraduate tuition goes up by more than otherwise would be the case. Student-faculty ratio goes up. So undergraduate students do currently bear some of the cost of research. And cutbacks in the time path of federal research funding, or cutbacks in the level of federal research funding, which we may anticipate will occur in the future, is going to exacerbate this problem, because given our limitations on our ability to raise tuition, we can't go funding research increasingly out of undergraduate tuition. And then, of course, the fourth problem is that instructional expenditures have declined relative to everything else that we do at the university. And some institutions, including Cornell, have begun to take steps to reduce administrative costs. What we have learned is that reductions in administrative costs have cost for faculty and staff in terms of extra workload. We have to, in the future, figure out ways to reduce administrative costs and to deliver high-quality education at lower cost. So what do I think is going to happen in the future? I can talk openly because I'm not an administrator. So anything I say bears no relationship on what actually people will do. These are my personal views. These are the views about private research universities in general. And obviously, where you are in the wealth spectrum will determine how dramatic the changes will be. Harvard, Paul is going to show us some data in a moment on comparative endowments per student. If you're Harvard, Yale, Stanford, or Princeton, you can do whatever you want. Institutions that are a lot poorer than us really going to have to hustle, and we are going to have to figure out how to adjust. So what's going to happen? We're going to see increased use of full-time and part-time non-tenure-track faculty for undergrad instruction. Paul is actually going to show you some data currently on how different institutions' faculty look like. I can tell you from economics, which is my discipline, that there already are some economics departments, Northwestern and Duke are two examples, where they employ large numbers of full-time undergraduate, non-tenure-track faculty, and these faculty bear most of the undergraduate teaching load of the university. We're going to see increased technology in teaching to improve the quality of instruction, but also to reduce cost. We're going to see increased sharing of academic resources across institutions. Ezra Cornell really condemned this university when he said, I would create a university, he may not have said this, but I'm paraphrasing, I would create a university where any student can study anything. We can't afford to produce anything or everything by ourselves anymore. We're going to see increased at research universities teaching expectations for tenure-track faculty without grants. The reason we're teaching less, many of us are teaching less now than we did in the past, is because we were able to get external funding for research. But as the external funding for research goes away, the universities are not going to have the resources to continue to keep our teaching loads at the same level. So that's true in fields where research funding has been plentiful, but the pain is going to come back and hit the humanist also, because humanists get special treatment, which many of the rest of us are not aware of, namely they get study leaves every third year when they don't have to teach. And the justification for the study leaves is you don't have the opportunities for the research funding that the scientists and the social scientists do. So what we will do is we will provide this sort of internal research funding in terms of time off for you. Well, if other people no longer are getting the research funding and their teaching loads are going up, it's going to be hard to justify the continual study leave for humanists. We're going to see modifications of financial aid policies. We have financial aid policies for both social reasons and private reasons. The social reason is that we care very much about education being a vehicle for upward mobility, and we care very, very much socially about making sure that students from less advantaged families have an opportunity to come here. But there also are private reasons for this, and this has to do with we care about the selectivity of the institution, and we're worried about the middle. I've been getting the signal to go quickly, so I will just sort of point out these other things without going into to details, and just simply point out that Cornell, at real disadvantage in terms of trying to think about increasing usage of the facilities in evenings and in the summer because of our unique locational disadvantage. So a concluding thought, many faculty members, especially faculty in arts and sciences, worry that some of these revenue-enhancing strategies will take time away from what they view as the core missions of the university, namely undergraduate and doctoral education and research. And efforts by administrators to encourage the adoption of these things often exacerbate tensions with faculty. My take as an economist is that I urge my faculty colleagues to think of these activities as ways to ease the budget constraint that the university faces, which in the long run will permit us to do more of the things that we value the most. But of course, these activities have to be conducted in ways that make sense educationally, and only after careful weighing of the benefits and the cost. And my faculty colleagues will discuss this today.
So- So up next, we have Paul Streeter, who is the Vice President for Budget and Planning. And Paul is a graduate of Le Moyne College, been here for about 20 years, and also has an MBA from Cornell, and has just, within the last year, taken over this very important task and has done a fabulous job so far.
Thank you, Joe, and I appreciate the opportunity to hopefully contribute some thoughts to the dialogue on this. I want to share data in three different realms that I hope will just provoke some thinking. First is endowment value and endowment value per student between Cornell and some peer institutions. And I want to then talk about the mix of degrees that we confer, again, compared to peer institutions, and then talk about the faculty profile that Ron mentioned in his remarks. I share this information, there's no value judgment, no determinant, but I think it's important to understand, at least as I thought about it, is what's the landscape we're competing with peers on? Is it the same landscape? Are we trying to compete in the same landscape? Or is our business model different? And how should we think about that? So it's in that context that we pulled this data together. Let me first share with endowment per student data. This is Cornell's endowment per student data from 1984 forward, and you can see that it's tracking at a nice upward slope. The dip that you see out here in the, oops, wrong button, out in these later years, this is the recession as it hit, and we've largely, you know, fully recovered from the recession, haven't advanced much further from that, but that's a 2014 number. Our endowment's about $5.7 billion. The top line is the endowment per student for just undergraduate students only, and the bottom red line is the endowment per student for all our students. So if you look at that, with that in mind of how we've tracked, if you look at this chart, which says how do we compare with our peers, and we're the red bar over here at $233,000 per student, measured on a total student basis. And undergraduate only, we'd be over $300,000. And here's Princeton, Yale, Harvard in these three categories, and clearly operating in a totally different sphere in terms of the amount of resources they have on a per student basis. We, compared to most institutions, if this was relative to all higher ed institutions, we're very, very far to the left of such a scale. We're ranked 20th. But compared to many of the folks we compete with, we're over here, and it's a combination of one, the value of our endowment relative to peers, and the size of our enrollment relative to peers. So moving from endowment to looking at degrees conferred, we took some data that used to be arrayed vertically and tried to slide it into a slide, so the size of the pies don't quite equate to the number of degrees conferred, and I can give you some data on that. But I think the takeaway here is to look at the mix of bachelor's and master's degrees between Cornell and our peer institutions. And as I look at it, there are, what catches my eye is that there's three institutions on this list that actually offer or confer more bachelor's degrees than bachelor's. We're one of those three. Brown and Princeton are the other two. And then you start moving beyond us, and these other institutions are conferring more master's than bachelor's. This is 2013 data. Just to address that size of scale, to give you an idea, in terms of total degrees conferred, Columbia awards the most, USC confers the most degrees, 12,875, Columbia 10,923. We're on here at just shy of 7,000 at 6,992. So again, just wanted to give you a sense of how do we compete in terms of, because it's the financial profile for a bachelor's degree versus a master's degree is much different. If you look at, this is that same data, again, apologize on the scale of the pie charts because it's not quite right, in terms of showing the number of degrees conferred. This is trying to show you a mix of the master's degrees. So this is taking the master's degree data, and the more colors you see, the greater number of degrees, the variety of master's degrees offered by a given institution. Just thought this was interesting to see is how how wide is the breadth of master's degrees offered by peer institutions. And again, you can see our mix here with business and engineering being the two dominant parts of the pies, and you can see other institutions, strikes me Harvard, Washington U, Southern Cal, Northwestern, Columbia, all with a much broader mix of master's degrees. So again, food for thought. As then you look at the degrees offered, look at it, you know, who's doing this work? What's our faculty profile look like compared to peer institutions? Cornell's this top bar, and you can see that we're dominated. The green and the orange color here are tenured. Green is tenured, orange is a tenured track, and the blue is non-tenured track faculty. So we're roughly 82% of our faculty are tenured or tenured track, and you can see how we compare to our peers. We're definitely at that higher end of the proportion of tenure track versus tenure track versus total faculty. And again, if you marry this with the slide, the data before, and think about the degrees offered and who's providing that, who's delivering that education, it's just it's a different mix between us and some of our peers. Just let you digest that a little bit. And then lastly, if you, again, marry this data and look at the number of degrees awarded per tenure track faculty position. So this is taking those preceding the data from the preceding slides and simply dividing the number of degrees awarded by the number of tenure track positions. And here's where Cornell sits on that scale. Darker color, both the darker blue, the darker red, is a ratio of number of bachelor degrees per tenure track faculty, and then the total bar with the lighter shaded color there is total degrees per tenure track faculty. And you can see that for those that are generating a lot more degrees with a different faculty profile, obviously their numbers are different here as you think about it from a tenure track faculty. So with that, I think that's leave that food for thought, and we can just talk about it more later. Thank you, Joe.
So I know that's very data heavy, and I'm going to continue this. So we should have like time for a little song and dance, but you don't want to see me sing or dance. So let's just go to the data. I'd like to show you five plots. We'll look at faculty size. You've seen that already, but I'm talking historically. How has our faculty numbers changed? How has the student enrollment changed at the same time? What are faculty hires and departures over the last 15 years or so? And how many non-tenure track academics do we have? And what's our faculty age distribution? Again, no comment on this, but I think these are the sorts of data that we need to know in order to confront some of the questions that you'll be hearing in the following. So faculty size, I was asked 2 weeks ago, that's how we all got into this a little bit, about aren't we at the highest we've ever been at, and by the Daily Sun. And I went to the local database and looked at numbers, and indeed we are at the highest we've ever been, 1,652, five more than we were 7 years ago. Okay, and you can see the story here is a gradual ramping up until the recession hit, and then an abrupt drop, and now a gradual ramping back up again. Okay? But we've grown 0.3% in the last 7 years. So let's move on and see what has happened to the student enrollment in the same time. That's somewhat different. It depends on what cohort you're talking about. The overall student enrollment has grown about 10%. In that period. Again, the faculty are constant, students are growing by 10%. But if you look, the undergraduate population has not changed too much. It's grown a little bit. The PhDs are almost stagnant. And the one cohort that has really grown is the professional master's and MBA programs. They've grown some on this slide, they've grown by a factor of two-thirds. And in the last 7 years, by 40%. Okay? It's a remarkable number, I think. And of course, in parallel with that growth means that our student-faculty ratio has also grown by 10%. The next number I'd like to look at is changes in the faculty numbers. It's a little bit garish, but I'm not pro at this stuff. And so what I've looked at now is the number of hires that we've made in each of the last years, shown here in sort of an orange color. The number of losses, these could be going into the great beyond, they could be going to one of our competitors, or just leaving, or retiring, any of those possibilities. And then the sum of those two is the green marks in between. Okay? And I think, I don't know much, but it looks to me as though these numbers are, in fact, you can even see this, I've averaged out the average number of faculty in this segment before the recession is 78, and lo and behold, the average number of faculty after the recession is also 78, number of faculty hires. Okay, but these numbers jump around just as the losses jump around. As we all know, you might have offered a couple of positions and you didn't get them, or maybe you had great luck and did get them. And so that's of interest. But a little real growth, I'd say, in terms of hires, despite the fact that we think we're in a faculty renewal program. When I showed these data originally, this growth in the professional master's degrees, many of my colleagues said, oh, the whole explanation there is that the non-tenure track faculty have grown. It turns out the non-tenure track faculty have not grown. That basically there has been maybe a 5% growth in the number of full-time faculty, but in fact the total number of faculty, and I just throw down early numbers and late numbers, but you can see they don't change very much, and I'm not hiding data, I'm just trying to make it a little bit more legible to you. So the number of contingent faculty is roughly the same as it had been before, and of course it's only about 20% of the number of tenure track and tenured faculty. Interesting. The last plot I want to show you is one that I found fascinating. You know, we've seen that the student demographics have changed, and the faculty demographics have also changed over the last 15 years. So these are age distribution starting in 2001 and going up until the present time. And I think what you see, or at least what I see, and your eyes are probably better than mine, is a relatively constant number of people. These are faculty under 35 years old, relatively constant, about 20%. The young professors, many of these now tenured, a sharp shrinkage, 40% cut in the number of mid-career faculty, a constant number. Keep in mind, this is complicated because, of course, people are leaving and coming. The folks that started out over here have drifted up over here. And so, you know, these are provocative data, I think. But I don't quite understand them, and I think they require a lot of thought. But they certainly are provocative that we're losing a whole cohort in here. And where is that, not that cohort going? Well, maybe these guys have gone there. But what's happening is the faculty is growing in its age substantially. We've gone from about 9% here over 65 to 21% over 65 at the present time. It's remarkable. And I think, you know, I just bring these to you now to say we ought to understand what these are saying and what do they mean for the future. And are there ways that we want to change this? Do we change the demography? The faculty are independent beasts, but this demography is certainly influencing the way that the university runs. Okay, that's my little speech. The next speaker is Charlie Van Loan from Computer Science. Charlie is the Joseph Ford Professor of Engineering or Computer Science, I don't know which. Former department chair, has run the graduate program in computer science, the undergraduate program, now happens to be in charge of the Master of Engineering program. he's a member of the University Faculty Committee, the UFC, sort of the organizational group of the Senate. And when I first started saying, you know, what's going on with the professional master's degrees, Charlie and another member of the faculty on the UFC said, what are you kidding me? These are vital programs. They are doing terrific things. And we have to keep them, we have to strengthen them, and so forth and so on. And so when we came up with this topic, I thought, here's our man to come and speak to us and tell us about it. And he's got a terrific presentation for you, Charlie.
Okay, thanks, Joe. So my slides aren't as professional as some of the earlier speakers, okay? So I have 2 points, and you can't disentangle them. So the first one is that there is revenue to be earned in this venue, okay? Maybe not $100, maybe it's just a metaphor, but there's definitely possibilities here. But to me, actually more important than that is that far from being kind of a threat to the UGrad and the PhD operation, you can't separate that out, that master's programs interact with these other programs in a positive way. Okay, so Joe mentioned, so I'm in computer science, and a snapshot right now of our operation is there are about 200 undergrads each year from 2 colleges. Our Master of Engineering is about 100 a year, 70 come in the fall, 30 in January. And our PhD operation is a little over 100. And I've, over my career, have been directors of all these things, and everything I say is really the sum from those experiences. Okay, so I want to talk about 3 different kinds of proximity, beginning, and I'm talking, of course, from CS, and it may translate into your unit or with some modification or whatever. So the key thing is, for example, we value undergraduate research. This has been really promoted in the last 20 years, and so there's a great thing about being at a research university if you're an undergrad. If you're a PhD student here, you have an opportunity to TA in a low-level course and to build up your expository skills. Absolutely essential if you're going to be an effective researcher. Our MEng program is 1 year, and we have a number of courses that are targeting that group, but they are of interest to undergraduates. For example, we might have an adjunct who has experience in industry talk about security and networks, okay? And this fires up undergrads, but also in our PhD pool, even if you're working on theoretical abstract stuff, you can be extremely interested in this kind of a presence in our curriculum. All I see are those red arrows, okay? And if it's done right, and if everything in moderation, those are very, very important things. Here's a second kind of proximity. And I had to study this a lot when Cornell Tech came on the scene because, when you are a director of our program, you have to figure out how to recruit students. You have to figure out, what's the difference between our program and that program. And, of course, the Cornell Tech entrepreneurship, external engagement, is sort of in your face the whole time. That's the underlying feature of the operation down there. But it's not orthogonal to basic research. It does not detract from basic research. It enhances it, okay? And so I think this is a really great venue to stress this point, okay? Because, again, there's concerns about Cornell Tech and whether that squares with the mission of the university and so on. I've never had a problem with that. But, of course, all these things have to be done right, okay? And take work. Here's a third kind, and I wish we could brag about it here at Cornell, but about 2 years ago at Stanford, they started what's called CS plus X, okay? This is not a making double majoring easy. It's about creating combined majors, okay? There are about 10 of them. I just put 4 of them up here, okay? And to me, this is a way of paying attention to the larger university scene. When we talk about revenue enhancement, as you go across the different departments, it varies. And to me, this is a very, very important acknowledgement about liberal education and that a field that often has technical overtones, can contribute to that larger scene. And it's also a reminder to me that this kind of an undergraduate background can set the stage for really interesting master's level work. And also, I might have a little bit of the history wrong, but for example, like 20 years ago, we were contemplating in engineering about bioengineering as a major. And the party line then was, you're better off doing a classic major, and oh, by the way, we have a master's program in this area that you can gracefully slide into. But then that field got more structured, and now there is an undergraduate major in there. So again, having a vibrant and flexible and open-minded respect for that middle degree can make a lot of good things happen. Here's some numbers. You know, everyone's putting up numbers. Here are mine. They have no decimal points, but they're pretty important, I think. So actually, when I first started doing the master's, I went over to, it was a surprise. My chairman asked me to do that, and I was taken aback. But I went over to the archives and looked at engineering, because engineering used to be 5 years, okay? And I went over and looked at the requirements and stuff like that. And indeed, 4+1 nowadays equates to, in volume of work, to what engineering students used to always do up until the mid-60s. Okay, so there's this argument that 4 years is not enough, okay? Then we have a large fraction of undergrads come in with with AP, and they can get out of here in 7 semesters. So you can sort of make a pitch about, in 9 semesters, you can walk out of here with a, say, master's. There are various 3+2 schemes around where you present the sort of like as a package. Yeah, 2 degrees, but you sort of your senior year sort of flows very nicely into the MEng. You do an undergraduate research project in your senior year, that can blossom into your MEng project and so on. And finally, this sort of gets back to the Stanford thing, 1+1. We've stressed in our MEng program that you don't have to be a CS person. You have to be have a number of courses in the field, but we're deliberately trying to attract students who, say, major in physics but did a minor in computer science. So 1+1. You don't have to necessarily have majored in the master's field. Okay, so let me sort of sum up, which is we do have to think outside of the box. And what is in the box, okay? I would say, you know, the idea that a 1-year master's program, you know, automatically degrades the research environment. It's just not true. It can, but it's not an axiom. I hate this word terminal degree, which is often applied to 1-year programs. We're all supposed to be lifelong learners, right? And what is wrong with taking a 1-year master's program and then going on and getting a PhD in some other field? What's wrong with that? Okay. Finally, this idea that it's narrow, that it's focused on some job-related thing. Again, it's just not true and doesn't have to be true. I've never read the 100 Greatest Cornellians book. I don't know if he's in there, but he should be. He's the first master's student we ever graduated, and so it's a proud kind of thing here. On the other hand, it turns out that he never got a bachelor's. Okay, so I just mention that because we have to be flexible, right? If this happened today, you know, how can we keep a master's? But in those days, there was flexibility, and people recognized genius and turned people loose. So so that's my talk.
So our next speaker comes from the engineering college. It's Catherine Caggiano, who is in operations research and information engineering is the IE now. Catherine got her PhD from Cornell, went out to a faculty post at Wisconsin. We were lucky to be able to bring her back about 7 years ago, and she's back in the OR and IE department. And she is distinguished by having just finished chairing a committee that oversaw all the graduates in engineering and did a survey of them and tried to come up with what's going on in that program, what were the good things, what were the bad things, and she's going to tell us about them.
So thank you, Joe, and thank you all for attending today. I am really delighted to finally be giving a talk outside of the engineering quad. It's actually really nice over here, so thank you for having us. As Joe mentioned, I direct the Master of Engineering program in ORIE. I've been privileged to do that for almost 8 years now. And in the landscape of what we've heard today, I think that certainly an interesting case has been made that, look, the landscape is changing under us. There is a strong interest in changing with it. And I think that when we start to talk about revenue enhancement and new program offerings and this sort of thing, and I think Charlie made a really nice case and some strong points that when we start to think about creative ways of having new program offerings, that it doesn't just have to be about revenue enhancement, that indeed there are ways to do this that in fact expand not only the educational value, but in fact the intellectual footprint of what this institution is about. And what I'd like to do today in thinking about new, perhaps, developments, new, perhaps, professional master's programs is to really outline two things. One of those things is just a series of questions that if your department, your unit is considering undertaking a new program offering, I think that this is a list of questions that may be really important for you to consider and may in fact help you develop a framework for building a successful master's degree program. And the second thing is that I've been in this role for going on 8 years now, obviously I'm skewed a bit by my role in ORIE, but I've had the privilege of being on a number of different committees that have looked across the engineering college. So most notably, I was asked to chair a committee that Charlie was on as well, to really take a look at the master's program broadly, the Master of Engineering program across the college, and ask ourselves the question, look, our mission is how do we develop a world-class sustainable program? Okay, what does that look like? What works here? And what I'd like to do secondly today then is to bring a little bit of what we've learned from that process to share with you, and for two reasons. One, to actually show that even though the MEng program has been around a long time, in fact, this is its 50th anniversary in 2015, challenges still exist. And in fact, sustaining a successful program is hard. It's hard, but it can be done. And in fact, it can be done very well, and it has been done very well by many of our units. So I kind of want to just share some of those thoughts with you to bring this list of questions into context. So again, my literature review for this is, as part of this planning committee, and this was one of a series of planning committees that had taken place over the years for various deans to take a look at the master's program and really try and understand, you know, what is it? How do we do this here? And our committee, like those that came before us, talked about, encountered some of the same sorts of challenges, many of which are being talked about today, in how to do this right, how do we balance these trade-offs. Now, one of the things that we did that hadn't been done before was the radical idea of actually asking our students about their experience. And I don't just mean a focus group. I don't just mean a couple of students. I mean all of them, all 613 Master of Engineering students who walked out of here with a degree between May 2014 and December 2014, or the January 2015 degree, we collected data from. And what we found were some results, some of which we anticipated, many of which we did not, and many of which really, I think, informed some of our recommendations to the dean, and some of which I want to share with you today, some of those results that, again, I hope will get you thinking about this. Now, I've mentioned here an article that I actually just came across as I was designing this talk and thinking about structuring these questions, because, in fact, this is a very, very, very short article written by Jack Springman a couple years back, but, in fact, outlines a very similar type of framework for if you're trying to implement something successfully, how do you go about doing that? And I found that it resonated very strongly with what, in fact, I already had on paper, so I just wanted to note that here for comparison. And I will just mention that while, you know, most of my experience is here within engineering at Cornell, and that while a lot of the talk in new expansion is outside of engineering, I have had the opportunity to think about these questions a little bit more broadly. So as Joe mentioned, prior to coming back here as a faculty member, I actually taught in the School of Business at the University of Wisconsin. I was an undergraduate, though, at a liberal arts college, the College of William and Mary, and I currently sit on their Graduate Studies Advisory Board for arts and sciences. So we take a look and try and help the dean understand questions about, okay, how do we try and sustain and encourage master's programs to succeed in areas as broad as, you know, anthropology to chemistry to public policy and, of course, my personal favorite, computational operations research. Let me just give a broad brush of the current Master of Engineering landscape. And as I mentioned, this is the 50th anniversary of the MEng this year. And as Charlie mentioned, it was once upon a time, in fact, a five-year Bachelor of Engineering degree that in 1964, the faculty passed a resolution to change this essentially to a 4+1, where that was an optional one that created additional flexibility in a number of different ways, not only for the students, but also for the university. Yes. 600 students were graduated, over 600 from many programs during this past year. I want to illustrate some of these numbers just to show that, in fact, 45% were domestic, which means we have a very large percentage of international students, and that among the Master of Engineering programs, that varies widely. Okay, so some of our Master of Engineering programs, including OR, are facing student bodies that are over 70% international, and that's very important when you have the vast majority of them whose primary goal for entering the MEng program is to enhance their career opportunities. Okay, so in fact, overall, our MEng graduates, 60% had job offers prior to graduation. Again, a broad range, a larger number, happily, were actually able to find job search assistance. Overall, many felt that enough courses of interest were offered, but again, we have a broad range here. And finally, and this was a yes-no question, would you recommend the Master of Engineering program to others? Overall, 86% said yes, but again, there was a broad range based on that. Now, I'm bringing these numbers up and these specific questions for a reason, and because they actually lead very critically into some important questions that I think may be very helpful for you to answer. And that is because all of these are related very, very inherently to the value that is generated from the Master of Engineering program, to the value generated not only for our students, but also in the long term for the faculty, for the departments, and the university as a whole. So if you are thinking about offering a master's program, some important questions to consider. First and foremost, what are your value propositions? Okay, now what do I mean by that? Okay, what I mean by that is, look, what's in it for, heaven forbid, let me use a business school term, the stakeholders, okay? What's in it for the individuals that are affected by and that benefit from this? First and foremost, the students. And it's imperative to not just guess at what this is. So to know, what is it that the students are actually hoping to get out of a program? What is it that they will come here and actually pay close to $50,000 a year for? Okay, so when we talk about revenue enhancement, I actually personally would prefer that we talked about value enhancement, because I think really in order to have something that's successful, that's what it needs to be about. Okay, but it's not just the students that this affects. We also, it's important to ask the question, particularly in designing this, what are the faculty going to get out of this? We tend to think of this as a, oh no, this is a service. Okay, the faculty are sacrificing their time and energy. Absolutely. Okay, as we said, there's no free lunch, but there are also benefits to be gained. There are enrichments to be had intellectually, as well as broadening, bringing in connections to industry, a number of these different things that we have seen and have done successfully in the engineering college. What's in it for departments and colleges? And again, of course, the substantial revenue stream that goes along with that, which may be thought of as the primary driver for that, but again, I'd like to make a case that should not be the primary driver, or at least should not be the primary factor in thinking about designing these things. And more broadly, okay, this impacts in the long term more than just students, more than just faculty and departments. It really does, as these students emerge and go into the broader professional arena and academic arenas, this is an impact on Cornell. They are the future Cornell footprint, and they cycle back to us. Okay, so what is it that you want to deliver, and how are you going to go about doing that? Okay, so what are the capabilities and resources? How will you address if there are gaps there? Okay, and one of the things that I'd like to point out, this is usually how people start asking, oh, well, what can we deliver, and how do we tie it up in a ribbon and present it and decide if it's worth it? I encourage you strongly, if you're thinking about this, go back to question one first, okay? That's a really important thing. And when you think about the types of things that have to be considered, it really is questions around this entire program, what I'll call program value cycle, okay? Cute pictures, but intended to mean that, look, if we're talking about really thinking about the applicant pool through the recruiting, admissions, decision process, we focus most of our energies of course here on the program itself, but even the value cycle after that, when we have hopefully high impact alumni that contribute in meaningful ways, not only to the current program, but potentially drive an applicant pool. So to ask ourselves, what are our capabilities and resources that we're going to bring to bear to do this in terms of leadership, administrative support, a number of the different factors that are actually very important to think about as you are designing this. And understanding that there are going to be gaps, of course, but it's important to think about what those trade-offs are as you try and answer the question, is it worth it to proceed? So I'll have to say, I stole Charlie's $100 bill and I copied it, okay, for this presentation because I thought it was brilliant here. But when you start to think about this question, most people think about it in terms of revenue that we can bring in, and then, okay, how do we try and evaluate, and some of these are intangibles, the cost of delivering value, and ask the question here, is it worth it? What I would encourage you to do is, again, think more broadly and recognize that as you are delivering that value, you are also receiving this back as well, and not to ignore the benefits of the value that you ultimately will receive in the long term when you are trying to make this very weighty, perhaps, decision. Okay, so last question to consider then is, how are you going to measure your success in actually meeting these value propositions? And again, I won't go through this slide, but there are a number of different ways to think about, okay, how will we know what success looks like? How will we know if we are providing value to the students, the faculty, et cetera? So just some key things that I'll leave you with that I have learned, I believe in the M engine. Again, this is coming from my own experience here, is that it really does make sense to focus on the long-term value to be gained here, not the short-term revenue. Trade-offs need to be made in this, of course. At the end of the day, if you have to pick the one thing, the student value has to come first in this. Ultimately, they're the ones who are going to determine whether this experience was worthwhile, and that ends up driving the whole cycle in the long run. Having said that, the faculty value proposition has to be there. Faculty participation in this is essential. And notice that I don't say faculty buy-in, I say faculty participation, okay? There's a big difference. It's easy to sit in a faculty meeting and to think, that's a great idea. He's gonna do it, or she's gonna do it. I'm not gonna do it, okay? If you're in, you're in. And folks, it's important to recognize that skin in the game is important. That doesn't mean that everybody is an expert in everything. It's important to get the right people in the right roles. And that may mean bringing in non-traditional faculty members, okay, who have some of the expertise that perhaps is not the primary concern of core traditional research faculty. And finally, to really, don't be afraid of asking. I was once asked a dean, you know, whether or not they had an exit survey, not here, for students, and her response was, well, no, because if we got the data, then we'd have to report it. and we were kind of afraid that we'd actually know, okay? If you want to do this and do it successfully, you cannot be afraid to do this, okay? So that's my message. Apologies for going over, but I hope that that gives you all something to think about. Thank you.
So our last speaker is Francesca Molinari from the Department of Economics. Francesca was educated in Europe and comes with a different perspective. Her PhD, though, was from Northwestern, and she has co-chaired the committee in arts and sciences that looked at revenue enhancement within arts and sciences. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you, Joe, and thanks to everyone for still being here. I was born and raised in Italy, as you probably will quickly hear from my accent. And I'm going to view my talk as a sort of wrap-up of the presentations from Catherine and Charlie. And in particular, I'm going to talk about master programs, challenges, and opportunities. And what I learned, or what I think I learned, on this topic comes from my involvement with the Revenue Enhancement Task Force in the College of Arts and Sciences, which was in place during the last academic year. The task that we were given was to find new sources of revenue for the College of Arts and Sciences while maintaining the college's commitment to academic excellence and to undergraduate and graduate education. The task force had what I consider a broad representation from the college, and which is put here on this slide for you to get a sense of what I personally mean by broad representation. And the result of our effort, which consisted on weekly meetings from mid-December to the end of May, trying to think of ways in which we could, of strategies that we could propose to the college for revenue enhancement, boiled down in the short run to a call for pilot proposal for master programs and mid-career and short courses. We also considered online education, both at the higher education level as well as for high school. Okay? Here, given the topic of this talk today, I'm going to focus on master programs. So why think about master programs? Why did our Revenue Enhancement Task Force come up with the idea of master programs? In the first instance, the reason is because teaching is what we excel at, together with research. So it's a natural first step to think about doing master programs. My point of view on masters is that if correctly designed and run, master programs can in fact help us to fulfill our goal of creating lifelong learners. And of course, we do need to make sure to create value for the students. On that, I completely agree. However, during last year, I've had several meetings with, one meeting we had with the chairs in the in the College of Arts and Sciences. And then we also had a meeting with, a faculty meeting with the entire faculty of the College of Arts and Sciences. Of course, not everyone showed up. I heard a lot of the question, is this program going to be exploitative? You know, are master programs going to be exploitative? And so I'll bring my perspective of someone who did her college education in Italy, and I have to say, I find it surprising that a master program is considered potentially exploitative, and an undergraduate program is not considered potentially exploitative. Let me explain my point of view. I don't mean to demean what we do here. I love what we do here. That's why I'm still here, and I didn't go back to Italy, you know, to eat good food. The reason is because in Italy, my parents put me through college for 4 years with a total, including books, of maybe $4,000. That's what I paid for an absolutely excellent education. Again, I don't think I would be here if my education was not excellent. So on the other hand here, the tuition, even with the tuition packages, is enormous for an undergraduate education. So how is that? What is this binary situation where paying all that money to go to college is okay, but also trying to go the extra mile to distinguish yourself from everyone else who has a college degree somehow becomes exploitative? That I don't understand it. And of course, I completely agree with what Catherine said before, that whether the program ends up creating value or not, hence, which is another way to say being exploitative or not, depends on what we teach. But that's in our hands. That's our job as good faculty, to teach things which have value. That's my first point. The second point is that designing a master program can help us to rethink our approach to higher education. And here on one side, I'll go back to Charlie's slide about the CS plus X, which was actually that Stanford initiative was discussed abundantly in the Revenue Enhancement Task Force last year in the College of Arts and Sciences, because we all, or many of us at least, thought that that was a really creative idea in terms of how to rethink and enrich the way that we educate, and perhaps do that through the vehicle of the master program. And the other thought which I have goes back also to a point which was in Charlie's slide, which is sometimes 4 years of education are not enough. And I really believe in that. That's, by the way, the reason why I ended up here in the United States, but in a different way, which had nothing to do with the PhD program. When I was a junior in college in Italy, I showed up to the office of one of my professors and I asked, what should I do to get a job at the Bank of Italy? That was my professional goal in 1996, was to get a job at the Bank of Italy. And what my professor said is, in a very colorful Italian way that I will not repeat, is that if I want to get a good, interesting job at the Bank of Italy, I need to get a master's. And I need to do that outside of Italy. That's an interesting perspective too. So what I ended up doing was to get a master's in Italy and come to Northwestern to do my PhD. I do love academia in this country, and I decided to stay in academia. But my point is that if in 1996 in Italy it was not enough to get a college degree, to get a really good job, I find it, you know, a job that you're proud to go to in the morning, I find it hard to believe that we can really deliver that with, for every single discipline in a 4 years of education, even in a place like Cornell. Okay. So now to go to more details to what we came up with regard to master's programs last year, we thought of two models. One is the small model, the small program model, which we also named the excess capacity model, where one creates a master's program which is small in size, 5-10 students. And so relatively little additional investment in terms of number of faculty or staff is needed, though of course it still requires greater commitment from the existing faculty. So again, going back to the idea that faculty needs to participate. The other model is the large model, where one inevitably will increase the faculty size so as to offer a large-scale program, which is going to have a lot of new courses and so on. And here we're thinking about 50, 60 students per year or more. Okay? The expanded model, of course, makes most sense in disciplines where the graduates can easily find jobs. Again, going back to the idea of the value proposition. And one can also think of blending these programs with online. For example, do a program which is 70% online and 30% on campus, with this idea going back to the earlier point that Ron made in one of his slides, where he said that the location of Ithaca constitutes problems to create challenges for some of these programs. Okay? So by blending online and on campus, one may try to go around some of these challenges. So in terms of benefits and costs, again, here I'm repeating things which were said before, but on the side of benefits, for the departments and the colleges, there is the additional revenue, so the $100 bills, potentially an expanded size of the PhD program, because if one goes with a large master, then one will need additional TAs, and so can in principle expand the size of the PhD program or fund better the PhD students. There is the potential for an expanded faculty size, so that can help in various dimensions. It can help us excel in research. It can help with the age distribution problem and so on. And on top of everything else, one would get additional contribution to the financial aid packages. Of course, there is no free lunch, and so one will also face substantial costs. One cost is that of faculty time, the involvement of the faculty to run the program. Then there are practical aspects, like one needs an administrator to run the program. And so what I mean by administrator is, for example, dedicated staff members which help with the day-to-day running of the program. And then, of course, there are these costs which are not monetary, but they are sizable, which is worries about the quality of the students that we're going to admit. And then, again, involvement with the admission process and so on. And finally, the use of the infrastructure. So if one brings additional students to Cornell, there is going to be spillover to the use of the Gannett, or spillover to the use of classrooms, spillover to the use of cafeterias and so on, which I presume needs to be looked at from the overall perspective of the university. Okay. So what considerations should one make to get started when thinking about master's programs? Well, a given unit, department, or school, or college that it might be, has to think whether this would be a one-year or a two-year program. What's going to be the short and the long-run enrollment? And how to get started? So do you start with a full class size of, let's say, 50 students, or do you start with 10 and ramp up? And as you get, and so if you start small and then need to scale up, how is that process going to happen? And is there a commitment on all parties involved to actually, in fact, put the resources in place to be able to scale up? And then there are the practical considerations. Should it be a master's program with a thesis or without a thesis? And should we have how many courses which are brand new and designed for the master program exclusively should be put in place? And should the master students be relatively insulated compared to the undergraduate program and the PhD program? Or should we blend across? Again, this goes back to the various considerations on proximity that Charlie had earlier in his slides. And would a given unit do it in partnership with another department or with another school? And again, this is the CS plus X proposition. And then finally, something that I encountered when thinking about a possible master program in economics, there is the unknown of the accreditation process, which somebody described to me as realizing that there is a Pandora box to be opened. So there is the best advice is to talk to the graduate school earlier rather than later. Okay, so let me sum it up. My view of master's programs is that they offer new opportunities and new challenges. The biggest new opportunity that I view, personally, is that it gives us a chance to rethink our approach to higher education. And while when I say rethink our approach to higher education, it seems perhaps too bold, I have to say we all rethink our courses yearly. Every year I think, I look at my notes a month at least before I start teaching, and I think, okay, should I still teach this? Or is there a way that I could deliver this content better? We all do that. So why can't we think about whether there are other vehicles like postgraduate education, which is not PhD, that are going to allow us to deliver the knowledge that we want, okay? On the other hand, they present new challenges because the only way that this is going to work is if we do it right, and we have all been saying that this has to be done right, and of course there is no magic formula for what it means to do it right. How is the program, how should the program be designed, and how should the program be run? So, so that's all what I have.
So let's see, the panelists, if they would come up and take seats up here. What we're going to do is, while they're walking up, thank them all because they worked very hard at this. And then we'll have time for comments from the audience and responses from the panelists, if necessary or appropriate. And please raise your hand, identify yourself, stand up. We have mics, and we would like to capture whatever you say so that we can put it on CornellCast and it'll be intelligible. So are there any people who have any comments? We can also have conversations amongst ourselves. Yes, in the way back. Why don't you wait for a mic? We've got one coming back, sort of testing our system. We can make it back there. We'll make it. I can't hear you, I'm sorry. Mic on? The tech is coming over.
Yeah, okay. Van Dyke Lewis, Fiber Science, Apparel Design. Is the assumption that a master's course should make a profit?
Is the assumption that a master's program will make a profit? Anybody want to take that?
Well, it does, of course. And you have to gauge, like in our unit, we target admissions for sort of like 90 plus or minus 10, that kind of thing. There's an eye towards revenue, but you know, it's driven by, when you look at those folders, it's driven by, you know, academic excellence and whether or not they can do the program. So there's no point denying it. Of course it makes money, you know, and the return we get from the MEng program is essential to running the department. There's no question about that.
Andre Kessler in the middle, please.
Evolution, I have to speak up a little bit louder. That's a very related question, but is the assumption also that we would have need-blind admission in master's programs? Because in a way, in PhD programs or in other graduate programs, we don't really have that, although we try to finance our students through TA ships, right? But is there a need-blind admission for master's programs?
I don't think there is any assumption made, except that you believe that the master's program, the resources you spend on master's program, will yield greater net revenue than if we had expanded the undergraduate enrollment by the same number. That's really, I think, the key question, that we think that most of these programs, the tuition discount rate will be lower than it is for undergraduate education.
Other comments or questions? Yes, Risa. Risa Leibowitz.
Thank you, everybody, for the presentations. Risa Leibowitz, ILR. What I wanted to do, and this might be things that various people have comments on, is think about the ways that the presentations go together. So if we're talking about a program that a master's program where it appears that what we're talking about is, as people pointed out, thinking about how to raise revenue, which immediately skews our thinking about it. So we have to say, well, what are we actually after? And if we're actually after revenue, well, that's the goal. If we're actually after some other value, as people pointed out, that's something else. So what I'd like to do also then is think about how that goes together with the growth in non-tenure track faculty nationally, right? And there are costs to us to say, well, if we really do want to grow revenue and we think about growing the non-tenure track faculty, there's a cost of academic freedom, of governance, of the sorts of values that we hold in other areas. Another example would be, are there any costs in terms of a loss of independence of the university if we build more industry partnerships? So what are some of those connections that people have seen?
Charlie?
As far as the non-tenure track and the professor, the practicing is coming down, I've always been pretty relaxed about that, as long as it's the proportions, right? That you control the ratio, so to speak, that you pay attention to that. And I do believe that non-tenure track people in these settings can really contribute stuff, right? So I look at that from that standpoint. What was the other part of your...
Can I just follow up with that? I'm not asking about whether non-tenure track faculty can contribute. Obviously they can. I'm asking about the cost to them and to the rest of us in terms of, if one of the motivations is building revenue, and if one of the things we do is cut labor costs by having non-tenure track faculty, and if we increase administration as we build programs, then there are real costs to the kinds of perhaps intangible but very concrete at the same time notions of the academic freedom of non-tenure track faculty, the loss of tenured lines. And, you know, this relates to...
Risa, maybe we should wait and let one of the people answer, please.
Yeah, I'm going to stop in a second. This relates very much, I think, to what Ron was talking about, you know, in terms of some of these issues that are kind of financially broader.
So the jobs at the private research universities are the best paying jobs. and non-tenure track faculty members, full-time non-tenure track faculty members at the private research universities, often earn considerably more than they could if they were at any other type of institution. And they have the ability to sort of associate with hopefully really bright colleagues and also really bright students. So to the extent that their contracts are structured in ways that provide them with job protection, just as at Cornell, we've sort of moved to a system where lecturers progressively go up to the ladder, become senior lecturers, have multi-year contracts. I mean, they don't have tenure protection, but it really is a pretty good gig. And that's how places like Northwestern and Duke have been able to get substantial numbers of long-term non-tenure track faculty who play very, very important roles in the educational process.
Let me just weigh in on this briefly as one example of a non-tenure track faculty member who is precisely in this position. First of all, I just want to back up, and it sounded earlier in your question, I just wanted to clarify. Revenue and value are not mutually exclusive. Revenue is absolutely a part of the value gain and part of the value proposition that I was talking about of a master's program recognized by both departments and the university level. I very pointedly actually left a tenure track faculty position to come back here and assume a non-tenure track faculty position, which perhaps raises eyebrows of people in here. I did so for a number of reasons, one of which is because I'm in a position right now where I can add the greatest value and I can get the best professional fulfillment because I do what I do. Okay, so everybody obviously is going to be driven and motivated by different things. I'm in a position which involves interacting with faculty, interacting with students. I get an opportunity to teach at both the undergraduate and the master's level. I interact with alumni. I interact with corporations. And yes, I do engage and bring in companies to sponsor Master of Engineering projects. That's and direct the master's program and wear a lot of different hats. But that's an environment where I function very well. I enjoy that. And I'm glad that our program is structured so that because I do what I do, I take the burden off of regular tenure track faculty members for whom that's not their strength or their passion. I want to make sure that I structure a program so that they can do what they do best, which is interacting with students, guiding students on interesting applied problems, and I'll try and structure a program as much as I can to take that overhead off of them in a way that's efficient, but in a way that, yeah, I'm providing value and they're providing value as well. So apologies for the lengthy answer, but hopefully that sheds some light.
Let's move to another topic if there is one. Yes. Please identify yourself and wait for a microphone.
Thank you. Thank you very much for these presentations. I'm Matthew Evangelista from the Department of Government. I had one question about the premise that draws mainly from Professor Ehrenberg's talk, and just to find out if I understood it correctly, and then a question about how this kind of model would apply to the social sciences and humanities, especially. What I understood is that we're in this fix because there's been a decline of external research money, and when that happens, the university makes up for it drawing on undergraduate tuition, and that if we want to maintain our level of research without adequate external funding, we need another source, and that would be tuition from master's degrees. I assume I'm oversimplifying, but that's what I understood. Otherwise, I don't understand why we're in this fix.
That's a small part. The problem, the major problem, is that we broke away from a model that we used to have, which was let's confine our increases in undergraduate tuition to the rate of growth of family income. And over a 35 or 40-year period, we have progressively raised tuition by 2 to 3% more than the rate of inflation, which was 2 to 3% more than the rate of growth of family incomes, because family incomes have not grown at all in this nation on average. And as a result, our financial aid bills went up, and the debt levels of students went up nationwide, and the political and economic pressure now is preventing universities from raising tuitions as rapidly as they used to in the future. And when we raise tuition, we only get to keep a little bit more than half of it because we're giving it back in the form of undergraduate financial aid. So the research thing is a problem, but it's not the major cause.
That's very helpful. I think it does make sense to put it in the context of broader socioeconomic issues like the growth of inequality and, as you say, the stagnation of wages. So my question about the master's programs for the humanities and social sciences is, would you have had a representative? I understand Professor Molinari from economics is the representative of the social sciences in that sense, but it's an unusual field in that students think that it really does give them value added to have higher degrees in economics. I'm not sure it would be the same in my field of political science or in English or in history. I have the experience of my elder daughter who graduated in romance studies from NYU, and every job she applied for required a master's, and not one of them said in what field. This speaks, I think, to the issue, you called it exploitation. I think of it as something different, maybe inflation of credentials, or we would say in my field of international politics, an arms race, right? That everybody has to have a higher degree in order to do better. And I think that in some fields, students will recognize that and they'll try to get the most practical degrees. So these combined degrees that Charlie was talking about with computer sciences, it makes a lot of sense. I don't see it particularly in other fields. And what I worry about for the character of our department, the educational environment for our other students, especially at the postgraduate level, is that we would have paying students in classes with students who are PhD students who are being funded on fellowships. It's worth it to them to have a low stipend fellowship, spend 5 or 6 or 7 years getting a PhD, to work in a relatively low income field. We were, 20 Cornell on the endowment, so we're doing pretty well, but they're gonna get the jobs on the other end of the spectrum, except for some exceptional ones. It's worth it to them. But I just find it difficult to understand that master's students would pay the same amount of money without expecting a real career enhancement, and that we would have a kind of two-class system in our seminars unless we created a completely separate structure.
Let's give Professor Molinari a chance to respond.
So when we were last year in the Revenue Enhancement Task Force, we spoke about the issue that not in every field in the College of Arts and Sciences it would make sense to do a master's program. So I don't think that this, my interpretation of this panel, this forum discussion, is not that every single unit at Cornell or in the college in particular should think of doing a master's program. This is just a conversation about thinking in which cases and what departments would it make sense to do a master's program. So one of the things we discussed last year is that the first step, there's a good reminder, I should have put it as a bullet in one of my slides, but the first thing that a department needs to do is exactly to look into some kind of market research / look at what other universities are doing and so on to try to find out whether there is, as part of the value proposition for the students, whether there is going to be value for the students, are they going to actually be able to get jobs? Okay. But then the other part of my answer to this question is exactly about the blended programs, because there is a lot of value, in my opinion, in getting a degree which combines computer science and English. It's just we currently, as far as I know, we don't offer such a degree, but that's our opportunity to rethink the type of degrees that we offer. And lastly, I didn't completely understand your point about the PhD students and the master's students sitting in the same class. I think that's part of why we need to, when we think about creating a master's program, we need to think about what courses should we create that are completely brand new for the master's students and what if any, of the existing courses at either the advanced undergraduate level or at the PhD level, the master students would be most beneficial for the master program, depending on what are the goals of the program. So I think that that goes all into the design of doing the thing right.
I would like it very quick, and then I'm going to close the meeting.
So I talked to a colleague at another university who has a system in my field of master's, paid master's degrees, and fellowship-provided PhD programs. The paid master's students are the students who didn't get the fellowships to do the PhD program, and I think that's a problem. It's a problem of quality, and then it's a problem of knowing that this person was better than me is going on to the PhD. I have to do the master's. Maybe I can try again next time, that sort of thing.
So if I could wrap up, I think the discussion has been very useful at the end here. And to sort of respond to some degree to the last comments, I think the point of this was to not only look at professional master's degrees, but just in general. I think that we saw in the original slides that Cornell is unique in many ways, and that the university landscape is changing, and we need to be thinking about how we will change, or if we will change. We don't have to, if we will change in the future. And that's the sort of thing that the faculty ought to be doing and discussing in great detail. And lo and behold, we can do it over glasses of wine in the art gallery. So let's go for it. Thank you very much for coming.